welcome to another episode of Living Downstream. My name is Ryan, and I'm an AmeriCorps member serving in the role of Environmental Education and Outreach Leader for the organization Umpqua Watersheds. In this episode, you'll hear how bioacoustic technology is being used to assist scientists with collecting data, as well as some recommendations for catching a glimpse of birds and other wildlife, and suggestions for attracting various species to your property. I'm here with Damon Lesmeister, a wildlife biologist with the Forest Service, who will be sharing some of his knowledge about bird watching and bird listening. We're grateful to have you on the show today, Damon.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about some of the work we've been doing and some of my background in both bioacoustics and bird watching.
Awesome. To start things off, how did you first get involved with bird watching and ecology in general?
Yeah, I think this goes back. I think about this as even when I was a small child, I grew up in rural Missouri, and there's not much by way of urban activities. And so we spent a lot of time just kind of wandering around the woods, and definitely the vast majority of my childhood was spent outdoors. And so I think I became pretty fascinated with just the natural world and how things worked, and appreciated being able to just sit by myself in a patch of woods and just listen, and was always amazed at like how much I could learn by just simply listening. Just close your eyes and listen, and you could really understand what's happening in that little patch of forest where I would be sitting. So I was always really fascinated both in the natural world, but then also just the sounds that you would, you can observe in a place, and understanding like, if you're close to a train track or close to a highway. So those impacts of humans also, but then just also more of just the natural world. And birds obviously were among the most important aspects of that, the vocal aspect of ecosystems, and because there are such a, many vocal species. So really, really fascinated with birds, and I really enjoyed learning the different species, and also by both sight and sound. And so it was always, very much enjoyed that. Seeing what these different birds were doing and learning what that is just by listening to them.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could share a little more about how to identify birds by sight and sound. I don't have much experience with bird watching, but I understand that some people, look at the birds and can tell what types of birds they are, and other people listen to the birds and can tell by, what they sound like.
Yeah, I think that, every species of birds has a unique identifying sort of vocal, whether it's a call or a song. There's various different ways that you can identify species by just their vocalizations, and by sight, of course, that every species is identifiable, and some are much more closely related species sometimes can be tricky both by sight and sound. And so it definitely increases in expertise level, and certainly on the vocal side of things. And I there are definitely people that are much better at identifying birds vocally than I am. And it's amazing to me how some people, that spend their lives in birding, and just really remarkable at how good that people can be at identifying birds. And and on the ecology side of things, it's really amazing of what we can learn about an ecosystem by, if you couple expertise of humans to be able to identify birds, and then if we have some way, recording those things, we can learn a heck of a lot about an ecosystem.
Yeah, I understand that you're a song monitor. At first I envisioned, a person standing outside and listening to the bird calls, but the process is actually a bit more technical. Can you tell the audience about the bioacoustic system and the monitors you use to do that work?
Sure. Yeah. I think maybe the, first thing to talk about or to think is that, traditionally what we have done, and it still happens, this is very common for to do what's called point counts. So you have an observer, somebody that has a, some level of expertise in being able to identify birds by sound and sight. And, a common method is to go out and you have these points on the landscape, whether it be a transect or various different methods. And they would basically have somebody out with a data sheet, and they stand at a point and listen and look at and look for birds, and you record, and they do this in the field. And this is very common. It's happened for many decades, and it's been probably the most common method to do bird surveys. And what we have now, and certainly over the last decade, it has been remarkable in the advancements in the technology for our ability to basically put sound recorders with high quality microphones in the field, and that are they're battery powered, and we can basically strap them onto trees, and you set them to record at a given schedule. And then you can come back, you know, come back 6 weeks or whatever, several weeks later, and you record those devices, and you come back, and all of the sounds that were happening at that in that patch of forest or wherever you're doing your surveys are now recorded permanently on this SD card, and we can do various different things with that. And so it's really, I think it's revolutionized our ability for scale, especially the temporal scale, because you can imagine if you're a human, you're out there at a particular point. Typically, it's, you know, somewhere 5 to 10 minutes at any given point, and then you're moving on because, you can't have a human standing at every point for weeks at a time. And so it has really made a really remarkable difference in our ability, because these recorders, they're machines, and so they're doing the work for us. And we're getting, somewhere, over 350 hours of recording at every point out there. So our ability to now leverage that and learn what's happening in an ecosystem I think it's really made a huge difference. And we think about this as sort of next generation natural history, right? We're understanding the systems, ecosystems, and the natural history of individual species and entire communities. But we're able to do it now at a scale that is unprecedented in history. And because we can now leverage what humans are doing, we can take that effort now, and they can cover, any individual person can now cover a much larger area because they're dropping their devices and moving on. So, what we can do then, the challenge, I think, with these recordings is, we have, say we have 350 hours of recording at a given site. That's really high quality recordings. The challenge is now we can't just sit and listen to that. In the work that we're doing here in the Pacific Northwest, and we are, this year alone, we're going to be recording well over 500,000 hours of sound recordings. And so you can't have somebody sit and listen to all of those hours, because then that sort of defeats the purpose of having a machine out there doing the recording for us. And so what we do is now we leverage other machines, other computers now to scan these sound files for us. And we can train what's called a convolutional neural network. And it's basically, it's a type of artificial intelligence. So we teach this machine what the different calls look like. So we give it lots of different examples of, say, for example, a spotted owl or any species where we have recordings. And so right now we're doing lots of work with spotted owls and marbled murrelets and barred owls and lots of other species. So we give the machine lots of examples and we train it. Okay, this is what the call of a spotted owl. And it's actually what the call looks like, because we have spectrograms. And so you're probably familiar with this. This is a visual representation of sound. Along the x-axis, you have time, and then you have frequency along the y-axis. And then a sound then has, that sort of those characteristics, but then also you have amplitude, so brightness in a spectrogram. And so every species has a unique looking spectrogram that's related, the same as what their call is. So now we can give a machine, take this photo, which is a spectrogram, an image, and we train it. And so it's actually image recognition, not sound recognition, that the machines are keying in on. So we give it lots of examples of these spectrograms for the different species. And then we can then use that. We use supercomputers to do this and scan those images, just hours. I mean, hundreds, and we're well over a million hours of sound recordings now, and let that, the machine sort of go through that and then identify where we have the calls of interest. And a lot of the work that we do is focused around spotted owls. That's a really key important species for us. So the machine will scan those and identify, hey, here's a list of, you know, places within these sound files where there's a spotted owl call. And most of the time, as the machine, and it's machine learning, so it's continually getting better and better, and we retrain it to continually to improve it. And it does a really good job of giving us, you know, output that indicates, okay, these are places in the sound file where you have spotted owl calls. And then we can have human observers, these are lab technicians, that go to those places, look at the call, and verify whether it indeed was a spotted owl call or not. And we can do this with every species that we're recording. And, you know, in the Pacific Northwest, we have over 600 species that we can, and we're just starting this work in the last few years. And so we're over 30 species now that we're extracting all of the calls for, and we're just expanding that library for our neural network every year. And we anticipate that that will continue, you know, for the foreseeable future.
That's remarkable. Is the bioacoustic system able to detect like overlapping sounds? If there's, you know, let's say there's two bird calls happening at the same time.
Yeah, you've hit on one of the key challenges that we have. And so some of our early iterations of our model, our convolutional neural network, didn't do a very good job of identifying those. But like other things, we give it more examples of those overlaps. And so it's continuing to get better. And I anticipate that that will continue to improve. And it does have the ability to identify those different species within the same very short time period. But you can imagine in some places, like, you know, we have the dawn, what's called the dawn chorus. This happens in the springtime during the breeding, where you have lots of birds that are kind of calling on top of each other. And if you've ever been out, you know, sit in a, you know, patch of forest at dawn and just listen, there's lots of activity. And so that's one of our, you know, sort of a challenging aspect, but the work that we do is continuing to improve. And we can, I mean, there's, when we talk about bioacoustics, and in that we sort of think about individual species call identification, but we can also look at, communities. And so we have different indices that we can use, different acoustic indices that can indicate, you know, if you have the biodiversity and, you know, how many different species, and we can, and the level of calling activity, and then also identifying human disturbance. So, you know, any place where we're doing our work, we're documenting those things, the level of human disturbance, and have a better understanding of how that may affect the ecosystem.
Yeah, it's so interesting how technology can make humans' lives easier, and this is a definite example of that.
Sure, yeah, it's definitely a pretty major shift in how we are being able to observe ecosystems, and there's definitely varying opinions about, you know, how much we should rely on technology to do the work. With, you know, historically it's been technicians in the field. I'm sort of the viewpoint where we kind of need both. We need to have those people and have humans that are, you know, connected and understand what the meaning is, make meaning of the sounds of an ecosystem. But we can also leverage technology basically to scale up both temporally and spatially where we're doing our work. And so we know that in ecology, space or sort of scaling really matters both in time and space. And so if we can get really detailed information for longer periods of time and over a larger area, we're going to do a better job of understanding the ecosystem and all the different stressors. And if you have perturbations in the system, those are happening at various different scales. And so I think we can leverage it. And I think that's the key, is that we're in a place where we're moving away from field-based work. We definitely need to continue to have that. But we can, I think, leverage technology to help us to get this thing, to scale up our work. So I think can be more meaningful and ultimately help us better manage ecosystems.
I was thinking too that having a technical device outside, unless it emits its own sound or something, you might get birds calling that might, react to a person being there, so maybe you wouldn't get those sounds if a person is standing out there in that 5 minutes or 10, however long they're standing at that point. But maybe you'll record additional sounds of birds that maybe are a little more shy or might not be as willing to make those sounds when a human is standing there.
Yeah, I think that that's a really key point. And we think about with these, because if you have a human in the forest, that's a disturbance, right? It's, most of the time that's a pretty localized small scale, but it is a disturbance because, if you walk through even on a trail, birds sort of scatter and they become quiet. And so we having a device that's just out there, listening. And this is also, work we do in camera trapping also. So it's like you just have devices that are out there and observing things that you just couldn't do, having a direct observation from a human. And then there's just the sheer time also of the, just the amount of time that these devices are, deployed.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. Is there anything else you'd like to share before we end this interview?
No, I just, I appreciate it and would be happy to, if anybody wants to contact and find out more about the work that we do, the Pacific Northwest Research Station that we're doing with bioacoustics and how we're sort of planning to expand this work and to help, help land managers make better decisions or better informed decisions and our ability to do this at various different scales. I think we're really excited about where the work is going and what we've been able to do thus far and how we'll continue to expand this. And we see this expanding throughout the Pacific Northwest, certainly on federal public lands.
That was Damon Lesmeister of the Forest Service sharing how bioacoustic technology can help researchers collect data. We'll be back after a short break. Are you an avid reader? Then you should join Umpqua Watershed's book club. Turning Over a New Leaf is a book club for teens and adults who are interested in learning about environmental issues and working to make positive change. We meet once a month to discuss a book or topic. Email Ryan Kincaid, the AmeriCorps member serving as Umpqua Watershed's Environmental Education and Outreach Leader, at ryan@umpquawatersheds.org. Again, that's ryan@umpquawatersheds.org for more information. Do you have a high schooler who loves music, writing, or theater? We're starting a radio club for youths ages 13 to 18 to develop their own radio show. Additionally, we're lending science equipment to local homeschooling and non-homeschooling families as part of our Home Explorer program. If you'd be interested in borrowing a water quality monitoring test kit, microscope, or snap circuits kit, let us know. Or check out our website or Facebook page for more information. You're listening to an episode of Living Downstream on KQUA, brought to you by Umpqua Watersheds. Today we have Matt Hunter, who is going to talk with us about observing wildlife. On your website, it says that you're a consulting wildlife ecologist, field naturalist, and guide. What exactly does that mean?
Well, that's a lot of things, I guess. And as an independent wildlife ecologist, I can't do all those things all at once to a great degree. So depending on the time of year and even different years, I'll be doing more of one than the other. A bunch of years ago, I used to help lead pelagic field trips out on the ocean to look at seabirds and land-based birding and that sort of thing. More recently, I've been spending more time with writing, editing, and field research and that sort of thing. So that's a quick summary.
Cool. Yeah, sounds like a lot of different but connected types of things. Do you have any tips for observing wildlife?
Oh, yeah, all kinds of tips. One of the main things is just to get out and try it. There's a really high correlation between how much time you spend out looking and what you end up seeing. You can even see that with birders that find a lot of more unusual species. Well, it's not just because they have, you know, some practice talent. It's also because of the time they spend out there. And like anything, you can imagine, the more time you spend looking, the more things you end up running into. So that's probably the first thing, is just to get out and do it. And you learn a lot just while you're out doing that. One of the funnest things to discover and learn about are the associations of different wildlife with different habitats. So if you want to see more things, go to more different kinds of habitat. So for example, you know, easy places to observe like ducks and stuff are some of our local ponds, or good places where there's good visibility on parts of the rivers around here. Because those, you know, the duck, the waterfowl are just sitting on the water, fairly easy to look at. It gets a little harder if you start trying to look for mammals. And birds are fairly easy if you go to places where there's food or where they're feeding out in the open. But, you know, think about different habitats like the water, forests, open areas like grasslands and pastures and that sort of thing. And if you spend time in each of those areas, you'll end up seeing different species. You know, there are some generalists that occur in a lot of different habitats, but there's also specific ones that will occur only in those habitats. And even within those habitats, I remember learning a bunch of years ago just the difference between running water, you know, like rivers and streams, versus still water like ponds and lakes. They're actually, you know, whether it's amphibians, waterfowl, dragonflies, lots of other insects, there are actually whole groups of them that are specific to moving water habitats versus still water habitats. And same with forests, you know, look at conifer forests versus broadleaf forests, or oak forests versus cottonwood forests, and grassland, you know, open areas could be grasslands, dry grasslands, or wet grasslands. And there literally are whole different groups of species that inhabit those different kinds of habitats. So it's fun to explore and see different things that way. So that's sort of a step one, maybe. Or step two, get out there first, and then step two, look at different habitats. Another thing, I think not many people really think that they can learn the sounds of animals. You know, birds like make a lot of sounds, but even some of our mammals make sounds, you know, ground squirrels, chipmunks, Douglas squirrels, elk, and even some of the more rare carnivores make sounds. But you can really detect a lot of things that you wouldn't otherwise if you are familiar with the sounds that the animals make. And that may seem daunting at first, but honestly, it's not that hard if you put the time into it. You can start at your own house and or your favorite park or pond or something. Go out there and just start listening. And when you hear something, just go track it down. And when you discover what that sound is, and you do that several times, it starts to sink in, just like when somebody calls me on the phone and or says something to me from a little distance away, I know their voice because I'm familiar with it. Or I know which door in my house is opening, or I know, you know, what it sounds like when the trash truck comes down the road. You know, I know exactly which truck it is. And we can learn all those sounds of our local wildlife too, at least the ones that make sounds.
Are there specific animals, birds or mammals, that you look forward to seeing at this time of year, so going into winter?
Yeah, there are. So with the birds especially, there are some species that are resident all year round here, and even some individual birds. And then there's some of those same species, or even of different species, that migrate south and end up here. Or they may just show up for a little bit in the fall and continue south. One of the ones, some common ones that show up usually in September sometime are like the golden crown sparrows. I'm looking out in my backyard right now, and there's about a dozen golden crown sparrows out there. And they breed north of Oregon. They only breed about as far south as somewhere in Washington. But so when they show up, they're kind of a, you know, an indicator. Things are happening. Things are changing, moving into fall and winter. And the golden crown sparrows stay all winter. And you can even see if you have a feeder, or if you just go out looking for birds during the middle of the winter, you can see the golden crown sparrows start to change. The immatures start kind of dull when they arrive in the fall, and then in the winter they begin molting, especially around their head, to get more adult plumage. And by the time we get to say April, they've all got these thick, dark black crown stripes on their head. And so you can watch that change. But almost every fall, somebody's asking, what is this sound I hear? It sounds something like, yeah, maybe one of these will do it. But it's just this whistle sound, several notes, and people know that they haven't been hearing that all summer because that species isn't here in the summer. And so when it shows up September, October, they'll start hearing these sounds, but they don't know what it is, but it's very distinctive. And so that's one that kind of shows up, that kind of sings to us and lets us know fall is coming. But also in the winter, we get lots more waterfowl in our ponds and lakes. There are a few species that nest around here, but not very many. So we get many, many more species of waterfowl in the fall and winter through sometime in spring. What else? We get more raptors. You know, people are familiar driving up and down I-5, seeing red-tailed hawks mostly on the fence post next to I-5. And in the summer, that usually we don't see that, because in the summer, the red-tailed hawks are out. Well, they are in their own territories, And so they're a lot lower density in the summer. Whereas in the winter, we get a big influx of young hawks from points north and elsewhere that end up just hanging around in our open areas looking for something to eat. So that's another change that happens in winter. Occasionally we get something a little more crazy or exciting, you know, like a snowy owl or a Bohemian waxwing or something like that. That's really from points north that we don't get to see very often, but we're kind of always on the lookout for something like that.
I noticed that you have some great photos on your website. Do you have any recommendations for capturing a photo of wildlife, potentially moving wildlife?
Yeah, moving wildlife gets pretty hard. But in general, you know, yeah, I do take a lot of photos, and mostly for documentation. In other words, I'm an ecologist or naturalist first, and then a photographer. Some people are photographers first, and then an ecologist or naturalist. And so I'm a naturalist first, and then a photographer. So I have just used fixed lens cameras. In other words, my camera doesn't have an interchangeable lens. And that's just so it's pretty convenient for me to carry everywhere. And, you know, it has a pretty good zoom on it. I've had several different cameras over the last few years, but they all have a little more of a zoom, because anytime you're trying to take a picture of a bird, for example, it's hard to get any detail with your cell phone. Whereas if you're taking photos of flowers or a salamander, or a little insect that's not flying away, then you can get pretty good pictures just with your cell phone these days. But a lot of the, one of the main things is to have a good lens that will bring the critter in close for you. And then there are lots of technical details about cameras that somebody can just learn themselves, but you know, a larger sensor helps to gather more data, more light, and that sort of thing. So I think people can do their own research on all the exact camera details, but just being out there and waiting, be patient, think about where the light is, because if if the sun is out in front of you with the camera, you're not going to get great light on your subject. So sometimes if I know there's something I'm really trying to get a photograph of, I'll get some idea where I think it's going to be, and then position myself and wait and hope that it comes into good light. Because the better light you have, the better, you know, even less expensive cameras can take pretty good photographs if you have that good light. It's one of the main things really expensive cameras have is large light gathering lenses, large light gathering sensors inside. But that really helps in low light conditions. So, but if you have a decent, you know, mid-range, even a relatively cheap camera, and you get good light, you can end up getting some pretty good photographs, especially if you wait. And then with digital photography, of course, if you can just press the button and let it go clickety-click along, I mean, even professional photographers, that's how they get some pretty amazing photos, because nobody can know, you know, as the falcon zips across ahead when it's gonna briefly lift up its talon and scratch its head, you know. And so if you just take lots of photos, then when you get them back on your computer and take a look at them, you can find some interesting behaviors or positions that you probably wouldn't, you know, have been quick enough to just snap as soon as you saw them. So that's a couple things.
Yeah, that's a good point. You've mentioned a couple times being a naturalist. What exactly does that mean to be a naturalist?
Well, I guess I'll just say what it means to me. Everybody's probably got their own definition, just like what does it mean to be a birder or a lot of other things. For me, it just means I'm interested in the natural world, and I spend a lot of time looking and trying to understand what I see. And it goes beyond just putting a name on things, but trying to understand what any particular critter or plant is doing, why it's there, how it connects to other things in the environment. And I'd say that's pretty much what it means to me.
Okay. Can you share an interesting experience or something interesting you've learned regarding animals in nature?
This may be a little sort of broad and abstract, but when I was younger, like in my teens, learning some things, particularly about birds or plants, I remember really just wanting to, I was trying to learn how things were. In other words, with the idea that they are a certain way, and I'm going to learn how, what that way is, you know, whether it's distribution or what the animals eat, that sort of thing. I'm going to learn that so I know that. And, you know, that's a good way to start. But what I've learned over 30 or 40 years of watching and trying to learn things is that things change. And so even just what animals are here, like in the Douglas County or Umpqua Basin area, I can still remember in the early 80s, well, say in the 70s, there were no red-shouldered hawks here. There were no black phoebes. And in the early 80s, I think it was maybe both of them, it was either 81 or 82, both of those species were observed and photographed for the first time in the Umpqua Basin. They prior to that, were just south of here. Black phoebes had been in the Rogue Basin for quite a few years. But the red-shouldered hawks weren't even in Oregon before, I think, sometime in the 70s, and they just showed up on the south coast. But anyway, so they showed up here in the Umpqua Basin in the early 80s, I mean, just individual records. But then over the next 30-plus years, they become really common in the Umpqua valleys. Pretty much anywhere there's a pond or sometimes even no water and just an outbuilding, people will have black phoebes hanging around, especially in winter. And then red-shouldered hawks are really a noisy hawk. So, and they far outnumber red-tailed hawks in the summer. In the winter, I'm not sure how to compare the numbers exactly, but the red-shouldered hawks are really common and breeding all around the valley these days. And I had been out of the Umpqua valleys for a bunch of years in the 90s. And when I came back, you know, I knew there were black phoebes and red-shouldered hawks down here, but it just amazed me how many of them there were. And so that's one thing, is just things change, and that happens with, you know, the timing of when animals show up or do their things, and habitats change. You know, if you look at people that have studied habitat in the Umpqua valleys, a lot of the Umpqua Valley was just open grassland, savanna, patches of forest and stuff. just huge areas of open areas. And now, you know, there are some kind of woods just almost everywhere. And if you think about the age, a lot of these trees, you know, since the whole area isn't burned very much anymore, when all that burning stopped, a lot of these trees just started moving in. And so, you know, the kind of habitat that was here 100, 150 years ago is quite different than what we've got now. Plus, we've got all the agriculture going on. Another habitat aspect that has changed is with the Umpqua Valley's probably had a few relatively small wetland areas, but not really many ponds or lakes. Whereas now there are literally hundreds of little farm ponds. I mean, everybody has a little farm pond out in a rural area. And so if you think about, say, pond breeding dragonflies or pond breeding amphibians and that sort of thing, all those little ponds might actually have increased the habitat for those, some of those critters. So I don't know that that was really what you were interested in. You're probably looking for some interesting observation of some critter, but in the big picture, that's kind of an important thing to keep in mind, that things are always changing.
Well, I think it's interesting too to think about how humans impact the environment and how we kind of can cause some of those changes. You mentioned about the farm ponds. If we put in ponds, then like you said, there might be an increase in habitat for certain animals or insects that need a pond or something like that.
Right.
Yeah, so it's neat to think about how some of the changes, good or bad, can be something that people have inspired.
Yeah, almost any change in habitat is a plus for some species and a negative for other species. So, you know, we tend to judge certain types of habitat changes, and that's understandable, but it really is usually just a change from one kind of one ecosystem to another. So,
yeah, that's a good point. Some things are beneficial for someone and harmful for someone else.
Yep.
I saw that you also helped develop land management plans that benefit wildlife. Do you have any recommendations for the listeners who might want to intentionally make their land more hospitable for different types of wildlife?
Yeah, well, I can give a few little ideas, and I do give a lot of free advice. But for people that have larger properties that want something more comprehensive, they can also just contact me for, you know, a professional plan. But if you have, you know, whether it's a small area or a large area, if you remember some of the different habitats that I talked about earlier, think about enhancing or even creating some different habitat if you have enough, whatever you have room for, and think about the things that animals need, you know, food, shelter, water, cover. And for example, at my place, there were several kinds of old kinds of plums. They're small, you know, not very modern varieties, but and I've had to take some of them out, but I've kind of replanted and scattered them around. They're not native, but they produce a lot of fruit that in the late summer and fall, things like black-headed grosbeaks and western tanagers come by and just love eating all those plums. So, you know, you can plant native plants that have food for birds, if that's what you want to see. Things like cascara, twinberry. Well, you can even plant blueberries. You know, I have my blueberries that I want to eat, but if I don't cover them, the birds eat them all. So, you know, you can provide a variety of food like that that'll attract birds certain times of year. And other critters, you know, gray foxes love all the fruit too. They they're a cool fox. They can actually climb trees and they eat a lot of fruit and they'll eat anything else. You know, they'll eat your chickens. They'll eat voles out in the field or other rodents and that sort of thing. What's another one? Oh, red flowering currant is really fun because it's really pretty. Early spring, all the bright pinkish red flowers come out. And they come out around the time that the rufous hummingbirds show up in the spring. We have Anna's hummingbirds all year round, but rufous hummingbirds show up in late winter, basically. And if you have some red flowering currants, the hummingbirds will stake out a territory near those, and you might even have a nest hidden somewhere in a nearby tree or shrub. So you can also think of shelter. I know even if you have maybe a relatively barren yard or patch of ground, in the past sometimes I've just gathered either my own or my neighbor's brush clippings and just made a pile, a loose pile, so that a lot of the little birds can zip in there and feel safe. As far as creating habitat for critters on your property, I already mentioned just trying to create different types of habitat and provide food and shelter. And I mentioned some different kinds of trees and plants, and you know, you can research and ask local nurseries what would be good to provide some fruit and that sort of thing. So if you have a larger property, it gets a bit more interesting because you have more options and probably a lot more species possibilities. And so you can always think about water and types of forests and woods that you have, and you know, they're all different kinds of decisions the landowner needs to make in terms of what they want to do with their property, you know, because some people that maybe have a lot of trees, they may want to, maybe they're trying to grow trees that they can harvest someday for some income. So, you know, creating some open habitat might not work in that scenario, but they could just focus on the forest and think about, well, what creates better habitat or more diverse habitat for more diverse species in a forest. And so, you know, in forests, just having a few different species and having a few dead trees and some logs, those are some things that add habitat for more species in a place like that. And when you get into open areas, the real kind of dedicated grassland species really need large areas. Most people don't have that much acreage, you know, like say a western meadowlark. I'd have to look up the exact figures, but you probably need at least 25 or 50 acres before one would even show up, you know, I mean, to breed. They might come by in migration because they like it, that open area, but in terms of having breeding meadowlarks or savanna sparrows, those that really like the grasslands, you really need kind of a large area. And if you have a large area like that, then leaving some patches that aren't grazed, you know, down to the dirt will help those species, because they need some clumps of, you know, rank and old leftover grass to nest in. And then there are other species that, say, like killdeer or even bluebirds, that really like grazed areas because they like something closer to bare ground with just a little bit of vegetation. So even in those open areas, you can vary things a bit and provide some habitat for different groups of species.
Thank you for the suggestions. Do you have any other thoughts or ideas you'd like to share with the audience?
I have a couple. One thing for people that are interested in birds here locally in the Umpqua Basin, a few years ago with the help of the Umpqua Valley Audubon Society, I put together a website called umpquabirds.org, and it just has lots of different information on birds in the Umpqua Basin. And so anybody that's wants to learn more about birds around here, that's a great place to start. Another thing I learned about a few years ago was an online thing called iNaturalist, and you can get there on the web at iNaturalist.org, you know, www.iNaturalist.org, iNaturalist.org. And it's a place where you can, I mean, you can just look if you want, and you can query, well, what have people seen around here? What kind of, you know, maybe you've seen a beetle you're interested in. Well, you could just query beetles in Douglas County and to see if you see one that looks like the one that you saw. But to make it even better is anybody can upload photos of things that they see, just cell phone photos, even really bad cell phone photos, because some people that really know about whatever you've taken a picture of will be able to tell you, maybe, I mean, if it's really bad, maybe they can just give you a broad idea. But if you take a nice close photo from several angles, you might even be able to tell you exactly what species you found. And that's how iNaturalist works. You upload a photo, and maybe you all you know is it's a beetle, so that's what you call it. It's best to give it some sort of name. If you don't put any ID on it whatsoever, then the beetle experts, for example, may not find your observation until somebody calls it a beetle, because beetle experts will just look for beetles. They're just trying to identify beetles. So if you just call yours a beetle, some beetle person will look at it and try and identify it for you. So it's basically a community ID system. And it's a lot of fun. You can also just ask people about it. It's like, well, what, you know, how do you tell this one from that one? They look the same. And, you know, you can ask questions. And most everybody is, you know, really helpful. And there literally are, you know, it varies across the globe, but it's a global database. And there are literally experts on just about everything that Peru, they're not necessarily on there every second of the day, but you know, some of them, maybe the ones that look at true bugs, maybe they only pull up iNaturalist once a month, and then they go through all those bugs that haven't been identified, or crayfish or fish or birds or flowers or whatever. But it's a really fun thing to be involved in and contribute to. And I do quite a lot of that. So I've had a lot of interaction, you know, made contributions that anybody could do just because you're out there and you take these pictures and you share what you've seen. So, you know, I've been contacted by the state because I've photographed some invasive plant they were concerned about, or you know, taken photos of an insect that nobody's seen for 50 years, or taken photos of certain flowers that some of the botanists you know, haven't seen or don't see much in this area. So there's a lot of learning that can go on, and you know, you can get to know some people And it's just fun to, you know, we all kind of learn together, and it's just kind of a fun thing to be involved in. So.
Yeah, iNaturalist is a really helpful resource. I've used it as well. And I like the identification tool that you mentioned, as well as there are certain species, you know, I found an insect that I took a photograph of and someone helped me identify it. And then I was able to learn more about that species. So, you know, the distribution across the land, you know, where they're found, what season they're most likely to be found there, how many other people have, you know, found that same type of insect. So, yeah, it's something that I was like, oh, I don't know if I've ever seen this. It's actually fairly common. I just haven't noticed it. So it's kind of interesting to see, yeah, ones that are new to the area and ones that maybe aren't so new, but just new to me, you know. So, yeah, that's a great recommendation. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. And I am, yeah, grateful for all the insights and resources that you've shared.
You bet. It was a lot of fun.
The intro and outro music for this show are excerpts from the song Forest by Vlad Gluchenko, used under the Creative Commons Attribution 3.0 license. You can find more information about this song in Living Downstream's information section.